Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We have a returning guest today and we're really excited because Becky Langston Bass is back to talk about more women with London links, because that's what she does. But more women that we really don't know anything about in history and we really should. Becky, hello.
Hello.
This was such a success last time. We've got you back to do more. And you've got some cracking stories for us, haven't you?
Yeah, I had to narrow the list down from about 20 women to try and fit this in. So
You
hopefully they're
had
good.
three you really wanted to do, but you couldn't find stuff on. Just give them a shout out.
Yeah, so there were a few. Well, just as always, when you're researching for things like this, it's always just like, is there enough information? So the ones I didn't get to include was Clara Collett, who actually worked alongside Booth doing the Booth poverty maps.
Okay.
And so there definitely should be more about her and kind of how she was interviewing working women and things like that. But yeah, unfortunately, no biographies out there. Margaret Bryan, who was a philosopher, I'm not going to include, but again, very, very interesting. And actually, Elizabeth Wilkinson, who was a boxer, she is only known through her boxing activity. So we don't even know when she was born or when she died. We just know she was active in London for about 6 years in the 1700s.
Wow.
And she was willing to fight both men and women. So she was quite a bold character. But unfortunately, again, not enough about her. So those are the ones I wish I could have included.
No, damn. But you have got four really, really good ones for us today. The first one I have heard of because, and I think a few people will have, because we all get the Tudors rammed down our throats, because she falls foul of Thomas Cromwell. Well, not Thomas Cromwell, she's too late for that. She falls foul of basically Henry VIII, doesn't she?
Yes, absolutely. Anne Askew, who was born in 1521 and died in 1546. So yeah, absolutely during the reign of Henry VIII. She really does kind of her position. As in terms of like being born into her family, it really kind of backfires on her because her father's quite a connected man, and it means that she ends up effectively kind of being involved in the royal court. And it's during this period where she's involved with the royal court that she starts gaining suspicion for her kind of over the top Protestant beliefs. There's a lot written about her though that actually shows that it's not necessarily her beliefs, but actually the fact that she was such a strong woman that actually really put people off, and it meant that she was just kind of too risky to have about. And so they tried to implement her in various plots through her kind of later years. She was self-taught, so she taught herself to read and write, mainly using the Bible, which she then memorized passages from. And she actually ended up getting married because her sister ended up dying, so she ended up being married off to the husband that was going to be her sister's, a man called Thomas Kyme, and he was a devout Catholic. But because she was so young, she hadn't quite formed her own beliefs at that point. So she does later become very Protestant, and because she has her own opinions and she is very opinionated, they end up falling out quite a lot. Their marriage is the complete disaster. And in fact, he actually ends up kicking her out of the house. Amazingly, she tries to get a divorce, which for a woman in the 1500s, is completely, outrageous.
Which is good enough for the king, though.
I did think that when I was researching about Anne. I was like, it's funny that because Henry VIII can do it, so why can't she? And I love this idea that there's a bit of an urban legend that she tried to appeal to the king himself. I don't think it's true, but there are some sources that tried to claim this. And we do know that she contacted the Bishop of Lincoln though, where she was based, and yeah, she effectively asked if she could get a divorce. It didn't work. She then moved to London and basically just pretended she wasn't married. So she spent time in London using her maiden name rather than her married name, which again for the time was really unusual. Both her sister and brother were involved in the royal court, as I mentioned, and so she starts kind of hanging around near the royal household. And she is it's at this point that she tries to kind of, she's interviewed and asked if she can implement other people in the royal household close to the king who are basically creating plots. So she's kind of the gateway into that, and it really puts her position at risk. She's arrested on three occasions, so it's not a terribly happy story. And in the space of a year and a half, she was arrested three times.
So this whole period is when Henry VIII, so he goes and messes up the whole Catholic Church thing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But as he gets to his dying years, he really is trying, it's like Pandora's box, he's trying to put everything back in the box, isn't he, and backtrack a bit. So at this point, being that vocal and that up for change and stuff when he's trying to dial it back a notch is just the worst combination, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of a like you said, it's a weird situation where Henry VIII has caused this situation, and now being too Protestant and being too like kind of wanting reforms in the church was outrageous at this period. And so it definitely, that part of her beliefs was definitely part of her downfall, the fact that she was just too Protestant for the royal family, for the church and for the state. She also was a pamphleter, so she would post pamphlets and she would preach as well, which is again very unusual for a woman. So being in the public eye as a very strong female presence in the Protestant religion was just, you know, there's lots of boxes there that would have disagreed with the kind of situation at the time. And she also carried writings by Protestants who had previously been arrested, and some of them had been executed. So she was caught with writings that were basically banned at the time, which was one of the reasons she was first arrested. And she eventually was taken to the Tower of London. So again, there's a lot of amazing London links with a lot of the women I'm going to talk about for obvious reasons. But one of the sad things about Anne is she's actually one of the only women on record to have been tortured at the Tower of London. And being an educated woman, the records of her torturing actually exist. She managed to smuggle them out. And again, they're not the happiest read. She talks about being placed on the rack, which I'm sure many listeners will know is very, very painful. She was harmed so much by the kind of interrogation, by being tortured in this way, that actually eventually when she was executed by a burning at the stake, she had to be carried on a chair and placed because she couldn't stand, because she had dislocated too many of her ligaments and her bones had popped out of their sockets. So it's, you know, a very painful account. If anyone wants to read it, it's accessible online. What's really interesting is after she is executed, her story that she kind of wrote gets kind of rewritten by two different people. And it's actually these two accounts that are very problematic. Some of them, for example, the one written by a man called John Bale, he's actually really misogynistic, and his tones of her work, he basically interprets her words as the fact that Anne was actually, you know, kind of ignorant and didn't really understand what was going on, and that's how she got herself in this situation, and she was a weak woman and all of these things. So that's extremely unfortunate. The other account, which is written by a man called John Fox, his is a little better, but there is a lot that would have been edited and removed, which obviously from a historical point of view is extremely frustrating when things are edited, especially, you know, from a woman's perspective. What does always come across about Anne is that she was very progressive for her time. She had repeated confrontations with male authority figures, including her father, as I said, her husband. You know, even during her interrogation, she kind of mocked the men who were interrogating her. And she said, you know, things like, it's against St. Paul's learning that she, being a woman, should interpret scriptures, especially when there are so many wise men to do so for her. So, you know,
she terrifies them, doesn't she, basically?
Yeah, she honestly was just like nothing else at the time, and they couldn't control her. And because of that, it led to her downfall, unfortunately. She very famously wrote a ballad when she was in prison. And the opening verse, I think, is quite beautiful. She wrote, "Like as the armed knight appointed to the field, with this world will I will fight, and faith shall be my shield," which I think is quite a powerful opening verse. So yeah, very, very prolific kind of woman in her time, despite only living, you know, for a couple of decades.
This is the thing, she's only what, 25, 26?
Yeah, 26 when she was executed.
It's insane, isn't it? And it just, do we know what happened to her after she died? Do we know where they buried her?
No, well, she was burnt at the stake, so I don't know exactly what happened in terms of records. There are a bit like accounts about the execution, which again you kind of got to take with a pinch of salt, because there's some people who say that, you know, she was helped die quicker. Some people say that she never cried out at all, and so there is this overbearing idea that they definitely, you know, history has kind of reflected her as a very strong woman. But yeah, unfortunately we don't kind of know what happened to her afterwards.
She's quite inspiring. But she always struck me as someone, she just refuses to shut up for the sake of other people, doesn't she? She's just like, I could just give you what you want and stop talking and stop having opinions and stuff, or I could not.
Yeah, well, that's what I really like about kind of reading the account of her when she was being tortured. It wasn't that she didn't say anything. It wasn't like she was on the rack and refused to speak. She would speak. She just wasn't telling them what they wanted.
Yeah.
She would just mock them and use her wit and her intelligence and quote bits from the Bible that were talking about what they were doing. And so she also refused to be silent, even though she was in this awful situation. And I just think that does come across, you know, the more you read about her and read her own work.
Yeah. I really like that one. Thank you for that one. Okay. Your next one, are we going to do a painter next?
We are, yes. Sarah Biffin, who I kind of came across when looking at women that we could potentially talk about for our Women of the National Gallery tour. One of the things that you see a lot in early women painters is they tend to be restricted to certain types of art. And Sarah was more of a portrait painter, but she did miniature portraits, which are nowadays very collectible. She is amazing though, because she was born without any arms and without any legs. So she taught herself how to read, how to write, how to sew using needles. She was very talented at embroidery. She would put the needle in her teeth, and that's how she would sew. And eventually she taught herself how to paint as well.
Hang on, so miniature painting is a bitch anyway, because you have to do everything in miniature. Like with two hands, I wouldn't even try. So she's doing this presumably with her mouth?
Yeah, with her mouth.
Wow.
Yeah, it's and she does one of her most famous paintings is actually her own self-portrait, which I highly recommend people look up, because it's actually a very like empowered painting. And she depicts herself despite, you know, having no limbs, being very kind of, her posture's very strong, her face is very determined. And I kind of love that that comes across. And it was a self-portrait as well, which I think is just amazing. So her kind of journey into art is a bit unusual. She effectively gets scouted to join fairs and sideshows, and it was her kind of tag name was the Limbless Wonder. And the idea was that people would actually go to these fairs and they would actually pay to watch her, you know, draw, write, and you could pay for her to paint your portrait as well. So although she did actually initially start in landscapes, it became quite clear that her talent was actually in portraits. And it was during this time that she had exhibitions of her work were sold, paintings, autographs, you know, all of this. So she was quite well known in that kind of scene, to the point where she attracted attention from people higher up. So there was a man called George Douglas, the Earl of Morton, who effectively decided that he wanted to see if this was true. He had heard rumors about this amazingly talented painter and wanted to see her in action. And he went to a fair in 1808 and he paid for her to paint, and he was so impressed that he decided to sponsor her to receive lessons from the Royal Academy painter William Craig. So she managed to actually move to London, where she had a studio in Bond Street. And she actually went on to have a few of her paintings accepted by the Royal Academy, as well as winning a medal in 1821 for her art. She also was commissioned by the royal family to paint miniatures of a few of them. But again, I haven't been able to really find which members of the royal family, but I imagine that in itself. Apparently, a few of them are still in the royal collection today, these paintings by Sarah. Unfortunately, when the Earl died, she actually lost her sponsored her sponsorship and unfortunately ran into a bit of financial trouble. But she was eventually awarded a pension by the royal family, which again reiterates her kind of connection with them. She ended up moving to Liverpool, where she retired for a bit and then decided to come back later in her life. And eventually there was a public subscription arranged to actually help finance her life in her later years. So she was very prolific in kind of the 1820s to 1840s time, and she ended up dying in 1850 at the age of 66. Absolutely amazing. Probably one of the ways to show this is actually how much her art has sold in recent years.
I just saw that an engraving of the miniature was 137,000. One of those went for.
Yep, absolutely.
Done by someone else, not actually done by her.
So just an engraving of her self-portrait, yeah. So it was estimated to sell for about £1,000, and actually went for over 100,000, and that was just an engraving of a portrait, self-portrait she had painted. So that should tell you in itself kind of her, you know, how talented she was. There were quite a few good comments after the sale, because obviously it was so much more than anyone was expecting, and a few of the kind of art world commented on this, showing that, you know, it just highlights the fact that she was so talented, and, you know, the fact that she had a disability did attract bidders, because they had a profound respect for her being able to overcome that and still kind of make a name for herself. And, you know, it's still very difficult, you know, in our days, and we're talking, you know, in the 1800s, and, you know, they can think of few artists who achieved this, over being able to overcome this greater than Sarah. So I think, yeah, she's definitely someone people should know about, and should definitely try and see her art when it is on display in royal collections and things like that.
That's amazing. Do, if you're listening to this, do Google some of her stuff. I can't believe that she could achieve that with her mouth. Just like by nature of it, you're getting the right as you're painting. If it's in your mouth, you've got less control over where you put your eyes to paint, how close you put the miniature to you, or far away to get a perspective on it as well. It just absolutely incredible.
Like you said as well, with miniature painting, everything has to be so fine and detailed, and, you know, there's almost kind of nowhere to hide with it, because it is a small painting, so people are going to stare at it a lot more intensely when they do look at this art. And so, yeah, to be able to create those fine lines and to create the art, and also to kind of have a reputation that kind of went out of just sideshows and fairs, and actually led to her being, you know, heard about in kind of upper classes, is a huge achievement.
Yeah, it's bonkers. I'm even thinking about, so this is like my obsession now. They used a magnifying glass, didn't they? But how do you paint with a paintbrush in your mouth when the magnifying glass is in the way? She's just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. We're going sort of back to politics, aren't we, with the next one that you've picked?
Yeah, absolutely. So I chose Mary Prince mainly because we've just launched a new tour about the women of Bloomsbury, and she actually has a plaque in Bloomsbury. And I reckon of all the women I talk about on that tour, she's probably the one people know least about. And actually, I think people should probably know more about her than some of the other women maybe I do speak about. So I want you to include her mainly because her story is one that if you don't know it, you should. So she was born around 1788, and actually we don't really know what happened to her at the end of her life. I'll explain that in a little bit. But her time frame is 1788 to about 1833. So she was born in Bermuda, and she was actually born into slavery. So her mother was a slave and her father was also a slave. She actually had a few sisters who she was separated from at the age of 12 when she was sold into another family. They were sold into different households. So what kind of happens is she kind of bounces around various places. So she's in Bermuda for a bit. We know she ends up going to salt ponds. She also ends up in Antigua as well. And she kind of is sold kind of to various owners because she seems to come across as a very strong woman who any opportunity that presented itself, she refused to kind of be passive with. So even during kind of one of the accounts that she later writes about is one of her masters wanted, you know, she dropped some things and he was yelling at her and tried to beat her. And she kind of ran out the room and threw things at him. And so she kind of would fight back. And it led to the fact that because of this, it meant that she was kind of sold on and bounced around quite a lot. Working in the salt ponds was very painful for her. She spoke about kind of permanent disfigurement on her legs because the salt would burn her skin. And they would work 17 hours straight on occasion. It's not quite sure how she ended up at the salt pond. Some people think it's actually a punishment for her protesting against some previous treatments. But yeah, she ends up kind of being bounced around. Eventually in 1815, she sold to John Adams Wood, who is a horrible human being. I have unfortunately had to read quite a lot about him, and yeah, he's not a very nice person. During this time she works as a domestic servant for him, so she helps nurse his children, wash clothes, attend bed chambers, etc. It's during this time she actually gets involved with a church in Antigua, and she actually has learnt to read and write basic kind of words. So up until this point she was illiterate. She ends up being baptized at the church a couple of years later, and then she gets married to a man called Daniel James, who's actually a free man. He was a slave who actually bought his own freedom. So this in itself led Mary Prince to suffer at the hands of John Adams Wood, because he disliked this fact that A, she got married without his permission, but B, the fact that this freed slave would hang around their household, you know, hang around the estate, basically giving people ideas that this is possible. And so Mary was actually beaten more, and she actually recalls that her flogging increased after her marriage as a response to this. And so it kind of all just comes about. By 1828, the Wood family have moved to London to sort out education for their children, and they take Mary with them. It's not clear whether Mary requested to go or whether they decided to take her, but she's taken to London. And this is where things get a little bit grey, because in 1828, the public opinion in London is not in favour of slavery. But slavery technically wasn't illegal. So, okay. Yeah, it's a strange situation where Mary kind of comes to London and finds herself, in the eyes of people, free. But she's informed that if she were to travel back to Antigua, where her husband is, she could be re-enslaved. And so she ends up leaving the Wood household. Again, there were many fallings out and records of kind of fights going on and things like that, and Mary speaking out when she shouldn't. But she unfortunately struggles to find employment. And this is one of the reasons she stays so long in London with Wood. Eventually, she ends up being associated with the anti-slavery movement. So she meets a man called Thomas Pringle, who basically employs her in his household and attempts to try and free Mary. So there's various petitions that they try to put to Parliament to get her freedom. He also tries to appeal to Wood, who has moved back to Antigua at this point and left Mary in London. And he writes a letter back saying she's too dangerous to be free. You know, if we grant her her freedom, you know, there's no police that could control her, which I think is an interesting letter back, maybe, because it really shows Mary's you know, presence and the fact that she is considered a dangerous woman. Eventually, they decide that actually a good way to grant Mary's freedom, and maybe not just Mary's, but to actually help the anti-slavery movement, would be for people to hear Mary's story. And so being not so literate, Pringle gets her to narrate her story, and he gets a woman called Susanna Strickland to write it down. It's then edited, and in 1831 becomes a published book called The History of Mary Prince. So this is still a book that's available for people to read today, and I do recommend people do, because it's actually not just an amazing account of, you know, this time, but it's also the first account of the life of a black woman to be published in the UK.
Just like a female Frederick Douglass, isn't she?
Yes, absolutely.
Brilliant.
Yeah, the response was pretty positive, actually. Although there were a few libel cases that were raised out of the book. So Thomas Pringle actually sued an editor of a newspaper, who basically turned around and said the account was false, it can't have happened. So Pringle actually sued this gentleman and received £5 in damages for it. The second libel case was actually John Adams Wood. He actually sued Thomas Pringle as the editor, claiming that the book misrepresented his character. He actually unfortunately won the case.
Of course he did.
Yeah, which is annoying, because everything I've read about him, I doubt that she misrepresented his character. I think if anything, she was probably too nice about him, and could have even been harsher. So the fact that it did kind of create this uproar in the UK, and it did raise a lot of public opinion, it is claimed, and you can understand how it is seen with its success. Ends up being reprinted a couple times in its first year. It is seen as almost a catalyst to the anti-slavery campaign, this idea that the horrors that she talks about, the physical violence of the owners, you know, it kind of really does kind of kickstart and effectively lead to the Abolition Act a couple years later. So there's definitely an influence there, which is, yeah, definitely important to know. The other thing that's really great about the history of Mary Prince is that it isn't necessarily just statistics given. It is, like I said, a first person account, and it's actually really honest. And some of the kind of ideas in it, sometimes when you read history around this, people do feel uncomfortable because of what happened, and so she almost becomes an awkward heroine, in the sense that people don't necessarily want to remember her because it's remembering a darker past. But actually it's really, really important that, you know, she was able to have her story told, because so many others wouldn't have. She did get a commemorative plaque in Bloomsbury. It was done by the Nubian Jack Community Trust, so it's not an official blue plaque, but it's actually on the side of Senate House. So if anyone's ever around that, it's really annoyingly difficult to see. It's like a bronze plaque, and it's behind the gates of Senate House. So if it's not open, you have to kind of squint to see it. But it has been there for over 10 years now. And she was included in the London Museum at Docklands, the Sugar and Spice exhibition that they did there. There was a side and a section about Mary Prince and her influence and her time. So she's definitely someone that people should know about. Unfortunately, we don't really know what happened to her after the libel cases. We know she testified at both of them, but then she kind of just disappears. So I think the optimist in me, I kind of hope she went back to Antigua, you know, as a free woman, you know, reunited with her husband. You can see a kind of Hollywood movie kind of ending. Yeah. But yeah, unfortunately, nobody has yet to find what actually happened to Mary Prince after 1833. So yeah, a great story, but kind of a bit anticlimactic about the ending.
I feel like we need to go out and find what happened to her. I wonder if would she not have been getting royalties still?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know.
Let's try and find out.
Yeah. Reading this, it's one of those where I'm like, is it something you need to have someone in like the archives there? If they have them, is it possible to look at, you know, family history back far enough to trace this? Because yeah, she kind of just disappears from our records. So I would say
in 1837 you get, did she definitely die in 1833?
No. So we don't know when she died. We just know she disappears in 1833. There's no reference to her post that period.
So 1837, nationalised record keeping comes in. So we need it.
Maybe. Well, it sounds like a project.
New session, new rabbit hole. If there's anyone in Antigua listening that can help, give Becky a shout.
Yeah, let me know. I honestly just want to find out now as well. Yeah. So I'll update. If anything comes in, I'll let you know.
Brilliant. We'll do a Mary Prince special. But today, you've got one more for us.
Yeah, so this one's a bit of a weird one, but I just post-lockdown, I think everyone was cooking a lot in lockdown, and so I came across the first woman to actually publish a kind of modern cookery book.
Brilliant.
I just thought it was a really nice kind of just thing to know about, especially because we actually have a lot of kind of things we should give her in terms of credit, because her name is Eliza Acton. She was born in 1799, died in 1859. So again, just time frame. She was also a poet. So she wrote poems before turning her hand to cookery. And I actually think that is actually part of the reason her cookbooks sold so well. It's because they had this kind of beautiful poetry about how to cook. And they're really detailed, by the way, her cookery books. She was actually born and raised in Suffolk, so a lot of kind of Ipswich links. And actually one of the poems she ended up publishing was called The Chronicles of the Castle Framlingham, which, if anyone has listened to the Ed Sheeran song, that's the castle he sings about. So I like to think, you know, she was writing about the castle before it was cool to do so. But she was known for her kind of humour and wit in her poetry, and eventually her poems kind of lost a little bit of their momentum, and so she was decided to turn her hand to this cookery book that she published in 1845, and it was known as Modern Cookery for Private Families. So the thing that the book does, which is really kind of instrumental and something we can appreciate, is it kind of introduces the way recipes should be written for people to be able to cook them. It takes them out of kind of, you know, larger cooking settings, brings them to the home. And she does things like that we kind of take for granted, like listing the ingredients that you'll need. This was something that was kind of revolutionary for the time, giving, you know, timings on preparation versus cooking time, which again is something that's so helpful nowadays. But at the time in 1845 would have been, you know, completely different from how recipe books would have been written. The recipes that she includes, this book is extremely long. I think it's over like 700 pages long. So it's a big cookbook, and she took 10 years to write it. And it covers pretty much everything you would need to know to be a chef, or to cook any type of meal. There's a chapter on how to carve different meats, where different meats have come from in the animal as well, how to fillet different fishes, and how to tell the difference between different types of fish as well, so you don't get sold a rubbish type of fish at a fishmonger. She's like, you're looking for this type, and there's actually drawings to show what types of fish work better with different kind of recipes. About a third of the book, she's a woman after my own heart, because a third of it's on desserts.
Awesome.
And there's some sugary desserts. She honestly, there's ones that are like more sugar than anything else. There's recipes for different types of vegetables, and there's about 7 ways to cook cauliflower, which, you know, I think cauliflower is an interesting vegetable. My favorite one is the one that includes cheese, because, you know, cauliflower cheese is amazing. She also is the first person we know of to recommend cooking Brussels sprouts, which I kind of have to not thank her for.
I want to go, you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the first recipe known in the English language for Brussels sprouts. So
what does it involve?
Pardon?
What does it involve?
Really, not very much. Steaming is effectively the method. She talks about taking off the outside leaves, steaming them, and serving them on toast or with butter. Again, Brussels sprouts on toast. Anyone want to try? Think
bread and butter could save Brussels sprouts. Have you tried making any of them?
Not yet, but there is a very nice recipe for Christmas pudding in there that includes a lot of alcohol, which sounds amazing. So maybe definitely get around to cooking some of them and see how they go.
I feel like this is a YouTube channel.
Yeah, cooking out of this 700 page book with all the different recipes. definitely something that if I'm not going to say it, but if I have an extra time on my hands anytime in the future, might be a future project.
So
it's just such an interesting cookery book because it honestly just covers every single area. And what's really nice about reading it as well, I kind of skimmed through it over the last week, is she kind of gives her opinion on some of the dishes. So she kind of talks about, you know, you can do it like this. I prefer cooking something like this. And if you want to add a little bit of kind of canine pepper, you know, that kind of adds to it. And so she's very kind of, it's a very kind of nice flowing book. It's quite easy to read because it has this kind of personal element to a cookery book, which obviously again is something that a lot of chefs try to do now when they bring recipe books out, is they do try and make it, you know, about personal kind of stories or different versions of recipes that they've tried. And so this is, you know, again quite important for that. She was kind of quite, there's a controversies raised, not necessarily because of the meals, although there was one that was called curried toast with anchovies, which I'm not again sure I want to try. Like, there was a lot of curries in this book as well, by the way. She was a big fan of including cuisine from all around the world, so she Brilliant. Included French recipes, curries, chutneys and things like that as well. So, you know, it is really all inclusive. But yeah, one of the things that kind of came out of it is that being the first kind of modern cookery book that was published, people just plagiarized loads of her recipes. And she actually, when the book goes to the 1855 edition, she wrote in the preface, "The manner in which large portions of my volume have been appropriated by contemporary authors without the slightest acknowledgement of the source from which they have derived is insulting."
I feel you.
Which I was gonna say, you know, from a historical point of view, plagiarizing is just, you've got no shame if that happens.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous case or a version of this is Isabel Benton, who is actually more famous for her cookery book, which came out in 1861. It sold, you know, a million copies. So it wasn't Eliza Acton's wasn't as successful, but it was the first of its kind. In Isabel Benton's best-selling book, Mrs. Benton's Book of Household Management, there's about 150 recipes that were directly taken from Eliza Acton's.
No!
Yeah. It's not even subtle. It's not even like one or two. It's about 150.
We actually have an episode of History Hack about cut and paste journalism and how about this was basically allowed at the time.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. It's why I kind of like that Eliza kind of wrote in her preface, you know, yeah, it might be okay, but it's like quite shameful to do. At least give me credit, which I think is quite cool. But yeah, you see her work being even referenced by like modern chefs. So Delia Smith has spoken out about the influence modern cookery had on, you know, today's world as well. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting book with some interesting recipes, but also was quite revolutionary for the time when it was published. She is buried in St. John's Cemetery in Hampstead Church in London. And just in case any of you happen to be around there and want to seek out Eliza's grave.
Brilliant. Oh, she sounds really cool as well.
Yeah, no, when I was reading the recipes, I definitely, there were a few where I was like, oh, that sounds good. The other thing I should say is, although it was pitched at kind of middle class families, and there's some ingredients that that were definitely for kind of the middle to upper classes, like, you know, there's truffle and champagne and things like that. There were versions throughout the book that you could make if you were doing it on a budget, which I think was really cool. Yeah, so she would make like and cooking the whole animal as well. So if you're using an animal, how to use all parts of it so there's no waste. So like things like that, I actually think meant that her book was probably more successful because it could be used by a wider audience than just kind of what it was targeted at initially.
That's brilliant. Becky, thank you so much for coming on to share four more women with us with London Links. Give everybody some details, because now we're coming out of lockdown, people can come and do tours with you.
Yeah.
Where can they get hold of you? Where can they find out about your tours?
Yeah, absolutely. So our bookings are currently open. You can find all the information about all the walks we do and dates available on our website, www.womenoflondon.org.uk. And we're also posting updates about our tours on our Twitter and Instagram, so at Women of LDN.
Excellent, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.